Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2021 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2021 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with the author of a new book about something that we are keenly aware of where we live, and lots of people are elsewhere around our country and the world as well. Tyler J. Kelly is the author of Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. He joins us to talk about his book, which is out by Simon & Schuster back in April of this year. Tyler, thanks for joining us.
Doug, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
What got you interested in river management?
Well, it was sort of arbitrary. I was on a camping trip with a friend. We were just putting down the Ohio River, camping on the banks. And we happened upon this lock and dam, which we didn't really understand much about what those structures did at the time. But our engine pooped out. And so we had to ask the workers there for help. And no one was really around. I think it was late in the afternoon. So we ended up spending the night at a lock and dam on the lower Ohio River. And the guys there were so hospitable. It was lock and dam number 53. Randy Robertson was the lock master there at the time. And I was really struck by, first of all, how old this facility was and how much of it was done with steam power and just sort of brute force. And it really was apparent to me right away that this was an entire world that I knew nothing about. But it mattered to the people that worked there, and it matters to the people who live by the river and who transport goods on the river. And so I remained fascinated by it from that day forward. And it just took a while for me to figure out, you know, how can I do a piece about this? And then I subsequently realized that that lock and dam happened to be, in addition to probably the most decrepit on the inland waterways, also one of the most important, because a tremendous amount of goods flows past that spot on the Ohio. And so when these locks and dams would break, which they did regularly until they were replaced in 2018, you know, barges would back up for 50 miles in both directions. You know, the ripple effects, I think, would go all over the world, with, you know, Japanese soybean buyers waiting for their beans and so forth.
Well, I know that part of the river. When I was a kid, we used to go to Tennessee and drive to Carroll, Illinois, to cross the bridge into Kentucky. And the last time I did that was about 10 years ago, and I could not believe how decrepit that bridge was. It's clearly seen not just better days, but days when people might have used it without arching their eyebrow. Why did you write the book?
Well, I was just interested, I guess, in the fact that, you know, one government agency, in this case, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, has sort of proposed to manage, to control these really powerful natural forces and sort of bend them to their will and, by extension, you know, our will as citizens of the United States to serve our purposes, transportation of goods, habitable floodplains, all these things that we have tried to get these rivers to do for us. So on one hand, the hubris and just the grandeur of that project, I was fascinated by.
The prelude in your book is titled Perfecting Nature, and I'm thinking back in the dam-building days of our country, back in the New Deal and that time, when, for that matter, when the Garrison Dam was built along the Missouri River in North Dakota. We looked at this way as perfecting nature. That's the title of your prelude. I think nowadays we would probably consider that with a, you know, kind of a little sarcasm.
Certainly. And I hope that that is implied in the use of the title. That prelude is specifically about the Missouri River flooding of 2019 and how unprepared the structures along the Missouri, especially the lower Missouri, were for that volume of water, which just, you know, obliterated all of the levees pretty much south of, I'm not even sure, Sioux Falls probably. And so, yeah, I'm interested in that idea, because I think you're right. A lot of the structures were built with a set of values and based also on a set of assumptions about the climate that may no longer be relevant or that we may no longer agree with in terms of values. So I think it's a good question to ask, especially when it comes to all this talk of rebuilding infrastructure or spending a lot of money on infrastructure or making more, you know, newer, better infrastructure. I think a question that kind of gets overlooked in those conversations is maybe we need to reimagine it first and ask ourselves, do these structures serve our purposes? Do they do what we want them to do? You know, and will they do what we want them to do for 100 more years? And so I think it's a particularly tough problem to solve. I think the Missouri has been really sort of messed up by I think it's a case of competing interests. So many people had tried to have a hand in making the Missouri do something for them that now it really doesn't do anything for anyone very well.
Well, the Missouri River and the dams that were set up along it had these competing interests, irrigation in the northern range of the river and then recreation and navigation to get bulk commodities down the river south of us. But that raises those issues that different states have different objectives. And sometimes, you know, holding back the water in North Dakota is a problem for the people in Missouri.
Absolutely. And I think that's another really important point to make, especially as climate change brings more precipitation into these basins. The winners and losers, there will be winners and losers, first of all, and they may be geographically very disparate. So you can find instances of that all over the country where a particular structure was arranged to privilege the interests of one place over the interests of another. So the flood control dams in North Dakota, Fort Peck, Garrison, and in South Dakota, you know, Big Bend, were built to protect Kansas City and Omaha, really, from flooding. And so there you've got a benefit that's 1,000 miles away, and you pay the cost, especially, you know, tribal nations paid that cost, giving up some of their best bottom land that they were farming underneath those gigantic reservoirs. And so I'm interested in who decides, you know, who benefits, who loses. And then again, looking at those as we go forward and saying, you know, is that still the right calculus?
Tyler J. Kelly is the author of the new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Tyler, infrastructure has been a prominent political issue in recent years. It's a pretty hot one right now. But nothing has yet come of the discussions and negotiations. How dire is the condition of the infrastructure around the Missouri and the Mississippi rivers that you chronicle in your book? You started out with a description of this ancient Ohio River lock.
Yeah, and I think you would probably have to go river by river or maybe section by section to really answer your question well. You know, I would say the flood control system, especially in the lower Missouri River, is in quite bad shape. And that's not because the levees were destroyed, which they were in 2019, but they're being rebuilt. But I think the problem there is the levees were never tall enough, and they were always put too close to the river. So the system of flood control levees, for instance, on the lower Missouri, is not and never has been really up to the task. It's less a science and engineering problem than it is a cultural problem, because when that system was built, again, you have these competing purposes. And so land creation and cultivation was one of the justifications of that infrastructure plan called the Pick-Sloan Plan. So farmers ended up building levees much closer to the river than the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers intended them to do. And what that does is it restricts and constricts the river and causes it to rise higher within its levees. And so you have a system, just to take the lower Missouri, that isn't going to work and never has worked and needs to be truly reimagined. So it's not so much that it's an aging infrastructure issue, it's just a bad piece of infrastructure issue. It never has worked. So you do have a lot of aging lock and dams, especially in the lower Mississippi right now. Those are some of the oldest we've got. The lower Illinois, those are really old. Again, all New Deal 30s stuff. The really bad one on the Ohio that I write a lot about in the book has been replaced. And so I would say the Ohio is in pretty good shape because it's had an upgrade. I think the entire length of the Ohio now has these new dams, which, I mean, this just tells you about how things get done in this country. They started replacing them in, I think, around 1920s. They started replacing the first generation of dams up on the top of the Ohio at Pittsburgh. And just now, 2018, they finished this replacement project. So it took about 100 years to replace the first generation of dams. Point being, the Ohio is in decent shape, I would say. The lower Mississippi has really good flood control structures, so probably the best in the country. So I would say there, it's not a matter of if the structures are good, but it's a matter more so down there of looking towards the future, you know, thinking about, can these structures protect the Mississippi Valley against the risks that are coming? And again, I think that question hasn't truly been asked.
Well, humans sort of gravitate toward the water. They build on the coastline or along the river, and the soil there might be the most fertile because it's river bottom land. So if policymakers could start over with management plans for America's principal rivers, what might they do differently?
So I think the simplest answer to that question for me would be just to start by realizing that flooding and farming can coexist, which is something a lot of farmers don't agree with. But I have seen some really compelling examples of land that is either protected by a low levee that is allowed to overtop when the river rises to a certain height, and then that water can drain off, you know, when the flood subsides, which is usually, you know, a couple of weeks, a month, or land that's protected by a screen of trees. It doesn't have the scour and the erosion that can come with a flood, and it does get the deposition of soil. Again, like you said, the best farmland in the United States is along these rivers, and for that reason, because the river built this land and the river can continue to replenish and enrich this land if we let it. And so I think there are a lot of interesting projects that you could do, or sort of maybe a pilot project or an experiment or a demonstration project that could be put together to show, you know, hey, if we put a low level of protection in front of this farmland, let's say it floods once every 10 years, figure out how frequently that is, the water can come over the levee won't get eroded, it won't be destroyed, the water will lay on the land and it'll subside, meaning the water will flow off. And I think many farmers would find that you can still get very good crops almost every year on this ground. And the people that I know that farm ground in the Mississippi floodplain, unprotected by a levee, almost always can plant their soybeans, I think, after June 1st. That's the maturation period for those seeds. And they get a really bountiful harvest on these acres down there. A farmer that I know named Lester Gooden farms some land in southeast Missouri. And that's sort of what I'm thinking about here. But so if you can give the river more room to spread out onto farmland, say, in a controlled way, then you can reduce the risk all around the region where you have these spillways or floodways. And so actually that reduces the risk for your cities, for your, you know, factories, your bridges, anything that you want to protect in that vicinity. So I guess that's where I would start.
Well, another complication with levees is that sometimes it's a farmer who puts up a levee. Sometimes it's a government entity. And who's ever levee is higher is the one who's going to prevail, because the lower levee is the one that will get flooded.
That's absolutely right. And there are some instances, especially of that on the upper Mississippi between Illinois and Missouri, northern Missouri. And so you're absolutely right. And what's needed in those cases is a holistic plan. And unfortunately, there is seldom an opportunity to put a holistic plan in place unless there's a disaster that really sort of wrecks everything. And so, the best flood control system we have in the lower Mississippi was put in place after the flood of 1927, which was the worst ever. I think it cost a third of the U.S. national budget at the time. The damages from the flood equaled that amount. And so you can look at other examples, and I haven't studied this extensively, but, you know, the flood in 1993 was really bad on the upper Mississippi and the Missouri. And so why, after that flood, was the opportunity, in my opinion, missed to put in place a better system? And I think you could say the same thing for the flood of 2011. And there's some interesting examples in 11 of engineers from the Army Corps of Engineers Omaha District going down to some levee districts in Nebraska and Iowa and saying, okay, let's set the levees back. And it was just a small scale program, but they were unable to accomplish that. The incentives weren't right. The way it was presented wasn't right. I'm not sure exactly why it didn't work, other than that the farmers couldn't afford it and didn't want to do it.
Well, you mentioned the flood of 2011. The Missouri flood of 2011 was significant in North Dakota and downstream, obviously. And we just recently had a news report that the Garrison Dam spillway was significantly damaged by an emergency release of water during that flood and will have to be repaired at considerable expense. The coda of your book is titled Retreat and Fortify. And in this coda, you describe another nation's experience with chronic flooding and how they've rethought their approach to it, and that's the Netherlands.
Certainly, and the Netherlands is well known, you know, really the best water engineers in the world. I was really interested to learn that Hurricane Katrina for the Dutch was a huge turning point in terms of their thinking about their relationship with water. And so not a drop of the storm's rain crossed the Atlantic, but it was the idea that a storm could catch somebody so unprepared and the consequences could be so grave, you know, as the consequences of Katrina were in New Orleans, and how the Army Corps of Engineers clearly was not prepared for that. And so that caused the Dutch to commission a study of their entire system, you know, which occupies vast portions of their country. And they realized that they were not prepared for, you know, the rising seas and increased precipitation in the future. And so they went about doing two things: building, you know, taller, stronger structures, more structures, but also retreating from land proactively. One of the most interesting things to me about that was trying to look at the cultural and political ways in which they made this retreat palatable to the population. And so they created this thing that almost, I think, was like a game where local people could go into this sort of website and put in different scenarios. Like, imagine if my house was on a barge, or imagine if we had a park here instead of farmland, or imagine if, you know, I moved over here. And they could see how much risk reduction you could get from doing this and that and the other thing. And then they actually would propose some of these scenarios to the Dutch minister who was in charge of this effort. And some of those suggestions were actually implemented and taken seriously. And so I think one of the key things that I thought about is, how do you get a sense of the public good behind a change like that? How do you get the public to want to do that? Or how do you get enough of them at least to buy into it that you can have a majority that's capable of confronting the holdouts, because there will always be holdouts, and do what needs to be done? And so in the United States, you know, we have really smart engineers and they know how to do this stuff. But the question is the political part, the popular will part. That's what we don't seem to know how to do.
And in the United States, where we've had devastating floods in the 20th and now 21st century, we often refer to them as 100-year or 500-year floods. But I was struck by the Dutch approach to this, which is looking at some places in their country and planning for a 10,000-year flood.
That's right. And I think that probability is something that we, at least as Americans, have a really hard time of grasping. You know, what's a 1 in 10,000 chance occurrence? It seems so incredibly rare, right? Especially in a country where we, most places are protected against a 100-year something, you know, scenario at best. And so to me, that's just evidence of the vision of the Dutch planners, because they looked at weather out to the year 2200 when they planned this post-Katrina system that they planned. But I think it also is a different way of thinking about costs and benefits. So the Army Corps of Engineers and a lot of agencies within the federal government look at, you know, what are the benefits of something and what are the costs? And if the cost of building protection that is too good, you know, against the risk that's too rare, their equations don't justify spending the money to do that. And that's, you know, over my head. But, you know, some smart people have looked at this and they've realized, well, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers process doesn't really value benefits that are more than 30 years in the future at all. I can't explain it any more than that. But I think we could change those equations. We could change those economic models and the way we think about benefits and the costs going farther into the future.
Well, we've had in this part of the country a couple of 500-year floods that were separated by a decade or two. So it's time to perhaps rethink those kinds of benchmarks as well. And of course, we're facing the added risk of climate change, sea level rise, more extreme precipitation events. So we do need to plan for the foreseeable future and perhaps the unforeseeable one.
Certainly. And I think there are ways to plan for uncertainty, and there are smarter ways to think about what we're doing and how we're doing it by sort of acknowledging that we don't really know what's going to happen. I think a lot of the stuff that we've built, you know, back 50 years ago really had a hubristic level of assumption that we did know what was going to happen. And so there's another Dutch thinker that I quote in the book who talks about the sort of ideology of resilience and the ideology of anticipation, and how if you build things based on this anticipation ideology, you think you know what's going to happen. And when something happens that you're unprepared for, your systems fall apart. Whereas you can pursue this sort of resilience ideology, which says, okay, we know there's a high level of uncertainty here. So even though we're going to build a levee, we're going to plan also for that levee to be overtopped. And when it overtops, we're going to design it so it doesn't erode below sea level and take weeks to rebuild, which is what happened in New Orleans during Katrina. So again, it's a way to think about the things we're building.
There have also been moves in the last many years now, and they're ongoing, to allow rivers to return to their natural state. I think the Columbia River in parts of the Pacific Northwest, is they've had some dams removed to help salmon get to where they need to go and to alleviate other issues there. Is that something that should be looked at as future mitigation too?
Absolutely. And I think, again, the question comes down to what purposes do these structures serve? And so there are a lot of dams that, you know, were built for, I don't know, flood control or navigation, or maybe even in little rivers on the East Coast, they were just built for one mill, you know, to make some product that it hasn't made, and the mill is long gone. You know, some of these ones in New England are 200 years old, right? And so those don't need to be there. They don't have any benefit at all. But I think, you know, there are some instances where you could look at a structure that was built for navigation, and the navigation, you know, dries up for whatever economic reasons. But it turns out that a little town put their water intakes behind that dam, and the water intake assumes that the water level is going to be of a certain height. And I talked to a utility manager in Kentucky who was in a situation like that, and he was really worried because the whole system of dams had basically been abandoned for 50 years. But he said, I can't have this dam fail because my whole little area, my whole, you know, half of a county here draws its water from this pool. And if the dam fails, the pool drops and we lose our water. And so I think there needs to be a more robust system. The design life of a lot of things that we build is 50 years, and that means the structure is designed to last 50 years. And I think when we go out to build something, we should put, you know, some language in our legislation or authorization or whatever to say, at the end of 50 years, let's go back and look at this thing. And we'll say, should we reinforce it? Should we modify it? Or should we take it down? Because concrete only lasts 50 years, and maybe the justification for this project also will only last 50 years. And I think there's a lot of instances of that. But because we don't have that clause in the authorizing language of these projects, it's really hard to get rid of anything. So we have all these structures laying around that really aren't serving any purpose. You basically need a one-off act of Congress to get rid of something now, which is, you know, as anyone listening can imagine, quite a heavy lift.
Okay. Tyler J. Kelly is the author of the new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Thanks for joining us today, Tyler.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really enjoyed it.
Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson recaps the week's big stories, and we'll get a movie review from Matt Olean. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The director of the North Dakota's Office of Management and Budget says his office has received some guidance on how the money the state will be receiving from the American Recovery Act can be used. But Joe Morissette says there are still a lot of questions to be answered. Morissette says some of the guidance clarifies some of the intended uses for the money.
Definitely provides for a focus, an intent from the feds to focus the money on tourism, hospitality, travel, tourism, hospitality, travel industries that were most negatively affected by the pandemic. But exactly what that means, you know, is left to the state to decide and to still kind of interpret what's meant.
Morissette says some money can be also used for infrastructure, water and broadband, and he says some can be used to replace some lost revenue. Morissette says the legislature passed a measure to set aside $112 million for capital projects, but he says there isn't yet clear guidance on whether that will be allowed. He says of the $1.8 billion the state will receive, $800 million is already spoken for, outlined in language contained in House Bill 1395. He says he expects more federal guidance soon so he can make spending recommendations that will likely be taken to a special legislative session in late summer or early fall. Minnesota has lifted its mask mandate. The state says people who have been vaccinated against COVID-19 may go without masks indoors as well as outside. The CDC says such places as hospitals and public transit could still require masks to be worn, and the state suggests that people who have not yet been vaccinated should also wear masks. Minnesota Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm says this does not mean that all governments need to follow suit and lift their mandates.
Local authorities do have the ability to impose restrictions above the state level if they wish. That's been a core principle for many years in public health, but local jurisdictions have the right to go higher than a state floor.
Meanwhile, University of Minnesota public health expert Michael Osterholm says it may fall to the private sector to manage to make customers feel safe.
It's just like the old days of the smoking in restaurants. I heard time and time again that this would ruin the businesses. Just the opposite. More people went out because they wanted to go out now because they felt that comfort and protection of not having smoke throughout the restaurant.
Governor Walz was planning to drop the mandate as soon as 70% of Minnesotans 16 and older were vaccinated, or July 1st, whichever came first.
You know, democracy is kind of a messy process.
Twin Valley State Senator Kent Eakin says he is expecting lawmakers will need to come back for a special legislative session in June as talks continue between legislative leaders on developing a state budget. He says while there are differences to be ironed out, the problems are not insurmountable.
There were significant differences on the governor's emergency powers and the mandates that he had in place. Matter of fact, there were some that were issuing, you know, ultimatums that if he doesn't remove the mandates and if he doesn't end the executive powers, that they were threatening the prospect of shutdown. But now I think that's going to ease up now too, because, you know, yesterday the CDC had said that people, you know, who are vaccinated would not have to wear masks, and the governor yesterday had gone along with that.
Lawmakers have until midnight Monday to complete their work or face the need for a special session. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Oh, Dave Thompson, our news director in Bismarck, it's been a while since
heard
that chattering newswire in the background, which is, of course, the cue for us to talk about the stories that were making headlines this week.
Absolutely. Well, welcome back, Doug.
Welcome back, indeed. It's been fun, actually. I'm invigorated.
Oh, good.
You had a story, or I should say Danielle Webster had a story earlier this week, that we're getting more and more people vaccinated against COVID. And then just yesterday, we got the news from the CDC that if we're vaccinated, we don't need to be quite as particular about wearing masks.
Exactly. They're basically saying if you are vaccinated, go ahead and you don't have to wear a mask. And the rest of it's going to be kind of optional to wear a mask, but if their guidance is if you are not vaccinated yet, it may be a good idea to wear that face covering.
Well, in our part of the country, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, we're being pretty good about getting vaccinated, although it's slowed down a bit.
Yeah.
And I do know that the Biden administration's goal is a 70% vaccination rate, so we've got a long way to go to get there nationwide.
We certainly do nationwide, but, you know, maybe now with the masks being – the mandates being taken off, that might spur some people to get the shot.
Well, meanwhile, we did pass another little troubling benchmark, 1,500 COVID deaths now, more than that in North Dakota.
Yeah, it's 1,503 now, so yes.
And the OMB has questions about the use of COVID relief money. You just reported that, Dave.
I just reported that, and talking to Joe Morissette, our OMB director, said they're waiting for some guidance. They know how much money that's coming. It's going to be $1.8 billion. $800 million is already spoken for because a lot of that goes directly to cities and counties for that aid. So they're playing in the $1 billion range, and there are just a lot of questions, and some of the guidelines are still waiting for to see what they can use the money for.
Well, tourism, hospitality, and travel are mentioned.
Right, and that was specific, according to Joe Morissette, because it really did get hurt in this whole pandemic.
And then we've got maybe some money for career and technical education centers that Correct. Come out of this?
Correct. And they think that that's going to work because they did say infrastructure is part of this as well.
Well, meanwhile, the decision about how to spend the money has been a bit controversial. The legislature is going to get back together, right?
The legislature is going to come back in special session, probably. I've heard sometime in late July or maybe as late as early September, and then they can basically make the decisions now on how to spend it. Now, it's interesting because, you know, that was the purview of the state's emergency commission, and that they made the emergency commission made recommendations to the budget section, which are the House and Senate Appropriations Committees plus the leaders. They could only say yay or nay. But now the legislature has said we're the appropriators. So, you know, we've got a lot of money coming, and it went above that $15 million benchmark there. So if it's over $50 million, the legislature does have to weigh in.
Well, you've been doing these legislative review programs, picking, you know, legislators who are in the fray, and you've got the most important person in the fray right now will be featured on Tuesday, right?
That's correct. We're going to be talking with Governor Doug Burgum about what he thinks happened in the session, how his priorities went, and then I'm going to talk to him about, okay, you have a special session coming up. You've got all this money coming from the federal government. You know, what happens next?
Okay. Well, I was really intrigued by a story you had earlier this week that the governor wants the state to be carbon neutral in less than 10 years.
In 2030, yes. And he said this in front of the Williston Basin Petroleum Conference, which I thought was kind of interesting.
I did too.
But he is saying that, hey, that we've got the stuff that's already working. You know, if you add things like Project Tundra and the carbon capture things and using carbon dioxide for oil recovery, these things are already at play. And then I know there's been talk about this, and he mentioned it briefly in our discussion, that maybe you put greenhouses next to some of the power plants and then you pump the carbon dioxide there because plants love carbon dioxide.
Well, there's a talk of a possible tomato greenhouse out there in the Jamestown area where they've got that massive project that kind of went south years ago and now seems to be revitalized.
Right, and I've heard that too. And that will be interesting if they get that going, because you do have the carbon dioxide from that power plant there and perhaps from the making of this crushing plant, this soybean crushing plant.
I was really intrigued, Dave, that the governor makes this announcement about carbon neutrality at the Williston Conference, as you mentioned, and former Secretary of State Pompeo comes there to basically criticize all of this stuff.
I know. It's very odd. There's a bit of a disconnect there, but Pompeo was booked before they knew the governor was going to say this. And they didn't know the governor was going to say this until he said it.
Okay. Meanwhile, oil is a bit over $60 a barrel. That's the sort of promising news for our bottom line in the state. But
right.
The Dakota Access Pipeline litigation is a bit of a damper.
It is a bit of a damper because, you know, the judge still has to rule if the pipe is going to be shut down while the Corps of Engineers finishes its environmental impact statement. The judge has not yet ruled. The Corps is trying to insist, hey, that we can do this without the pipeline being shut down. You have an interesting dichotomy as well. You have the three affiliated tribes in Newtown saying, don't shut the pipeline down. You have Standing Rock saying, shut the pipeline down.
Well, the states that are 1 and 2 in the U.S. for oil production, Texas and North Dakota, I was in the Permian Basin a couple of weeks ago.
Oh.
And what a Mad Max experience that was.
Really?
That made Williston and Watford City, you know, 5 or 6 years ago look relatively tame, and that's a little scary.
Oh, my.
But they're looking at, of course, that price. They benefit from that $60-plus dollar a barrel more so than we do because
that's right.
The pipeline makes a difference, I guess.
It does, and you look at Texas, you know, a lot of refineries down there. Plus, you have shipping, so you can ship oil. We actually do export some oil, so you can ship oil from there.
And as I'm driving through this massive state, I am seeing an awful lot of wind generators.
I know. That's interesting, too. Texas is really picking it up when it comes to wind power. But remember what happened in the big freeze earlier this year. The wind generators were not equipped for cold weather. Like the ones in North Dakota really are equipped for cold weather. Texas, they weren't. So the generators froze up and they had some problems with natural gas being pumped. And they had some problems with oil pump because they were not prepared for that kind of a cold snap.
Well, it's a little amazing to think that they didn't have any glycol to put in the wind chargers. That's pretty startling. Dave, you had a report on Monday that the legislature wouldn't make the Public Service Commission's rail safety program permanent, and that did raise some hackles.
It did raise some hackles because, you know, they tried this as a two-year experiment, and the Public Service Commission has come back every 2 years to the legislature saying, look what we've done. We found thousands of defects that may have prevented derailments. And there is a group in the House of Representatives who just doesn't think it's worth doing. They're saying, oh, the federal government should step in. Well, the reason why the PSC stepped in, federal government's kind of shorthanded when it comes to rail inspection, and they're rail inspecting the entire country. So the federal government partners with the Public Service Commission to do the inspections locally. So that was the argument the PSC is making.
Well, I'm also remembering that the argument for these rail inspectors was prompted by fiery explosions of North Dakota crude oil.
Especially in Castleton or near Castleton. To think if that train was a mile further east, Castleton would have been in some trouble.
Yeah, so the House of Representatives in the North Dakota legislature thinks the federal government should do it. Good luck with that.
Exactly. And you have there's strong support in the Senate, especially Senator Lee from Castleton was saying, hey, this is really very important to the state of North Dakota because look what almost happened to Castleton.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about airport passenger boardings that they continue to improve, but we got a ways to go yet.
Right. It's still about 30% down from normal, but oh my heavens. If you think about April of last year when you went down below 5,000 airline passenger boardings in North Dakota, now we're up to about 62,000-63,000 passenger boardings. We're better than they were, but Kyle Warner, who is the executive director of the Aeronautics Commission, saying, hey, we think it's going to get better. We do think because there's pent-up travel demands. Businesses are starting to look maybe at doing some business trips again, although they've been on Zoom and they found the Zoom platform or the Microsoft Teams platform to be pretty handy.
Well, I have had the occasion to take a couple of flights for various reasons over the last several months, and it has been wonderful to be on planes. These were Delta planes in my case where half the seats were empty.
Right.
I mean,
social distancing.
We'll certainly remember the ease and convenience of that experience. And then the airports that were, you know, you could kind of run through them as opposed to, you know, herd through them.
Exactly.
So the old way is coming back. I guess
it is. It's slowly coming back, but it is coming back, I guess.
Well, that's great news for aviation, you know. A little more problematic for those of us who fly.
Yes, that's true.
Dave, you had a report also earlier this week that three North Dakota projects will get Environmental Protection Agency brownfield support. First of all, what's brownfield?
Brownfield is a program that says, okay, we're going to come in and do some mitigation in terms of hazardous materials on these projects. Then the companies can take it from there, or the cities or the counties can take it from there. And that's a way to clean up some of these messes before they become Superfund sites.
So who got the money?
Well, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa got it for the old San Haven Hospital. And you and I both remember that was part of that controversy with Grafton State School and the Association for Retarded Citizens lawsuit. The San Haven facility was originally built in the 1920s as a tuberculosis ward. And it's been sitting empty since 1987 and has been deteriorating. And I happened to run across one thing I didn't include in the story because I did see some reports that there were some satanic rituals around the building.
Good heavens.
So you're talking about the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa want to take it down and make it at least for the moment into an RV park and a camping area because it's close to the International Peace Garden.
Well, I've seen images of it, and it's creepy.
It is very creepy.
So the Dakota College of Botany will also get some money.
Right, and they're going to clean up a couple of halls there to, you know, enhance the nursing program and make it more of a medically focused program. So it's going to take some buildings that are underused and make them useful again because of this expansion of the nursing program.
And you and I, of course, remember that back in the day, including when we were kids, asbestos was widely used for insulation.
Absolutely, yes.
And that's a critical problem in these cleanup projects.
Certainly is.
And Mandan gets $300,000 for things that also create messes that last a while, gas stations and dry cleaners.
Plus you have the added thing. Remember the diesel spill, the BNSF diesel spill,
yes,
underneath the city of Mandan? It took many years to clean that up. And this is going to be kind of a final thing in cleaning that up too, because Mandan has some plans to do some downtown revitalization.
Okay. Well, Dave, we've managed to sum up the week.
Oh, yes. Very good.
So for all of our listeners out there, sitting to my is Monday. Enjoy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, Doug.
Take care.
There's this word, hickey. And this word normally refers to a little love bite, or, you know, a little mark that one might get on one's neck after an amorous affair.
Who thought of that? That is such a stupid saying. It's got to be wrong. So I'm calling you guys for you to set the record straight on this.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean, and now that masks are moving into the past, maybe more and more people will be going to the actual movies. This is one I saw streamed on television, Matt.
Yeah, Shirley, with Elizabeth Moss as famed horror and gothic writer Shirley Jackson, who wrote The Haunting of Hill House, among other many excellent short stories. But yes, I do think people will go back to theaters, Doug, with your first comment, but there has to be something good to see. And right now,
They're
still... We're still in this kind of limbo mode of films that aren't terribly good. So I had a DVD screener of Shirley, but this summer you're going to start to see In the Heights, Black Widow, and then in the fall, Top Gun Maverick, the Bond film. That's when I think you will see people in theaters, especially with the CDC, the statement on you don't need masks indoors if you're vaccinated. So that should get people back to the theaters, but they have to have something to see. That's the problem right now.
But these are... You're talking about big movies. This is not a big movie.
No, Shirley came out in 2020, and it was kind of seen as an Oscar bait movie for Elizabeth Moss, who had a great year. She was in the Invisible Man as well, which is a better movie. So one of the problems, Doug, when you make a biopic about a writer is how do you make the writing process interesting?
Yeah.
And this has been a problem for years in cinema. And I'm not sure anyone's ever really come to grips on how to grapple with this. So this takes place in Vermont at the college where her husband teaches, played by Michael Stuhlbarg, who's an excellent actor. And they have two people move in with them. One is his teaching assistant, played by Logan Lerman, and his wife-to-be, Odessa Young. And what follows, Doug, is kind of a Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf film. You have these two couples living together, and Shirley Jackson and her husband kind of get after each other. And they get after the young couple as well. It's almost like George Segal and Sandy Dennis invited over to Taylor and Burton's house in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. That's what they go with, kind of. But a lot of liberties are taken with this film, Doug. You and I were chatting off mic. A lot of liberties taken with Shirley Jackson's life. She had four children with her husband. They're invisible in the movie. We never see them. That's often something you see in movies. I call it the invisible children, the invisible child motif, because they clutter up scenes. You have to cast actors as the kids. Moss is very good as Shirley Jackson in various scenes, but the film is kind of bumpy. Is the film more about the young couple? Is it about Shirley Jackson? Is it about her writing? In the film, she's writing the novel The Hangsman, which is based on a college girl that disappeared from that college in 1946 named Paula Weldon. So she's writing this novel with the help of Odessa Young, who you know has moved into the house with them. But you never really get a sense of her writing style. You don't get a sense of what made her great as a writer. So I was a little disappointed in this movie, honestly. I could never quite get into it, Doug. It never quite had that fourth gear for me. Even though a lot of critics liked it, I found the film problematic.
Well, I read a lot of critics' opinions about the film, and one thing that jumped out at me after I read a couple by women was that this mm-hmm. movie is aimed at women. And it's about sort of the kind of life that women emerge from that was very prevalent back in the late 40s and the 50s, when women go to college because they want to be better wives kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so that theme, when I thought about it, is pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed.
It is pushed and pushed, but I just don't think dramatically the film is interesting enough to sustain its 1 hour and 47 minute length. Again, I wanted to know what made her a good writer, and I never get that from this movie. What is it that that made Shirley Jackson still well known to gothic and horror readers today? As I said, Moss is good. She plays her as very acerbic, very troubled. She hardly ever leaves the house. She's mean to guests who come over. She's flippant to people at the dean's party, at the faculty party. So we get some interesting scenes with Elizabeth Moss, who's a wonderful actress. But I wanted more. I wanted more of kind of what made this marriage tick, even though they're at each other's throats a lot of the time. And I wanted more of what made her a great writer before her untimely death at the age of 48 in 1965. I think the two young leads, Logan Lerman and Odessa Young, are kind of dim in their roles. The Odessa Young part is bigger because she kind of bonds with Shirley Jackson in the movie. But overall, I was slightly disappointed in this movie.
Well, you mentioned that Shirley Jackson died at the age of 48. Her most famous story, The Lottery,
yes.
was published in 1948.
It
and
was.
That's a story we all grew up with because it's a horror story that sort of has this realism about it, that this could happen kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people thought it actually could have happened back when the story was written, but it's obviously her imagination. But that's my Academy Awards trivia link here. What was the best picture at the Academy Awards in 1948?
So the films that were released in 48 or the ceremony held in 48?
The ceremony held in 48.
Gentleman's Agreement was best picture that year.
That's right. Gregory Peck. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Norman Lloyd passed away. I want to mention Norman Lloyd, Doug, age 106. He was the oldest living working actor up until about 4 years ago when he appeared in Amy Schumer's film Trainwreck. He was really the link to Orson Welles, Charlie Chaplin, Alfred Hitchcock. He knew all of them. He worked with all of them. And so he was the go-to guy for years as an interview if you needed to ask about those three legends. And what a guy, long career, Saboteur. He's so good in Hitchcock's Saboteur. Later, people know him from St. Elsewhere, Dead Poets Society. So what a life. 106, Norman Lloyd.
His last movie, Trainwreck, 2015. He's 99, going on 100. And that's when his son tells him he's got to stop driving.
Yes. He played tennis until about 4 years ago.
And he played with the greats. He played with extraordinarily famous people. I mean, his life is a history of the movies.
Yes, and he saw Babe Ruth in the 1926 World Series, and he attended the Dodgers World Series in 2017 in person.
And he regretted not being in Citizen Kane because he was a member of the Mercury Theater Company with Orson Welles and John Houseman.
Yeah, he'd have been perfect in one of those parts for sure in Citizen Kane.
Well, he was a wonderful actor, a guy who will be remembered long after all kinds of Academy Award actors to fade into the mist.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Lloyd was 106 years old.
Rest in peace.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Before he made the movie Crazy Rich Asians, director John Chu just wanted to be thought of as an all-American filmmaker, like Spielberg or Tarantino.
I never talked about my own cultural identity crisis, being Asian American.
Why he changed his mind, and how art changes us. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at noon, 11 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 14th. The Bismarck High School debate team was on a roll in the spring of 1932 as they competed for the state championship. Under the direction of Miss Pearl Bryant, Junior Birdsell, Lloyd Ode, and Francis Cox represented the club. According to the rules of the competition at the time, two teams were allowed from each school, one typically representing the negative or cons of the argument, and one typically representing the affirmative or pro side. However, the Bismarck Club took a different tactic that year, using one team that would argue both sides. The topic this year was whether states should have compulsory unemployment insurance. The newspaper frequently reported on the Bismarck team as they compiled one victory after another. They won in competitions against Hazleton, Mandan, Jamestown, and a victory over Velva inspired one of the judges to say it was one of the best high school debates he had ever heard. One interesting note on the matchup with Jamestown, there was a 25-cent admission charge to cover the costs of Jamestown's trip to Bismarck. Bismarck was soon in the semifinals, but that's where the winning streak finally ended with a loss to the team from Leonard. Afterwards, the Bismarck Tribune published this note from the local team. To the citizens of Bismarck, it is with great pride this year that the high school debate squad is laying aside notebooks and pencils. Although the team has surpassed all previous records, it has not been the work of the squad alone. It is the people of Bismarck who have made the victories and the glory possible. With a determined resolution to equal and surpass our record next year, we thank you all for the wholehearted support you have given. Signed, the Bismarck High School Debate Team. As for the state championship, the last team standing were Leonard and Larimore, with Larimore claiming the championship. It was no surprise, as Larimore had won 6 of the last 7 state championships. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pipcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Maz Jobrani, filling in for Peter Sagal. The pandemic might be passing, but good news, we're about to be swarmed by screaming bugs. We'll try to talk over them on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Monday on our show, May 26th of last year would have been Peggy Lee's 100th birthday. Of course, observances were delayed by the pandemic and moved to this year, so we'll talk about the plans to celebrate that 100th birthday with Wes Anderson of the Barnes County Historical Museum and Holly Foster Wells. She is Peggy Lee's granddaughter. And we'll have an excerpt of Dave Thompson's legislative review with Governor Doug Burgum. So we hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. And if you're in the Medora area, you've got a special treat this Sunday at 5 Mountain Time. The Great American Folk Show will perform at the Town Square Patio in Medora. This is part of the production process that's ongoing for the show that you hear on Prairie Public's radio network. So enjoy it at Medora and enjoy it on the air. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.